Sit
light.
At my table.
Dignity.
Security.
Free.
Jump.
Freedom.
Respect.
Justice.
Justice.
Justice. Justice.
Justice.
Equality.
Equality.
Remedy. And protection.
Fairness.
Fair time.
Criticism.
Right.
Peace.
Men's.
This is my mistake. Let me make it good. I raise the wall, and I will be the one to knock it down.
Asylum.
Identity.
Family.
Home.
Conscience.
Expression.
Expression. Expression. Expression.
Participation.
Democracy.
Welfare.
Work.
Work.
Leisure.
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 Health.
Education.
Culture.
Human rights.
Charter Dana.
Solid.
Responsibility.
You fill in the mortar. I raise the wall, and I'm the only one. I will be the one to knock it down.
Good afternoon to all of our listeners on CJTR Community Radio at 91.3 FM and over the internet at cjtr.ca. We can also be heard on Sastel Max at channel 806 and Access Communications Digital Service at channel 700. Wherever you are, welcome to Human Rights Radio, hosted weekly by Amnesty International volunteers, who are a worldwide movement of people dedicated to the promotion of human rights and the safety of all human beings. We're building a world in which every person enjoys the rights included in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and other human rights standards. Our theme song is titled 30 Words, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, written and performed by REM and a collection of musicians from around the world. I'm Jim Hutchings, and with me is my co-host Gord Barnes and guest host Daylene Sliz, and by telephone, Amnesty International Death Penalty Abolition Volunteer Coordinator Aubrey Harris. Welcome, everyone.
Good afternoon.
Welcome to the program, Aubrey. So great to have you join us.
Yeah, I'm glad to finally be on.
Aubrey, this is Daylene here. To start out our program this afternoon, I'd like to ask you, what drove you to get involved with Amnesty International and, more importantly, the abolition of the death penalty?
I'd always been somewhat aware of Amnesty International when I was younger, and then I considered them to be quite a good organization, but I didn't know that much about them probably until I really joined in 2000 when I became a monthly donor. And at that time, I asked specifically for some urgent action cases on the death penalty, as I'd had a bit of an interest in it from university and sort of my own research that I was doing after that. So that was how I really got started. And then as I continued to write urgent action letters, I became more familiar with the kind of frequent issues that were recurring within each case, such as, you know, unfair trials and innocence and other cases like that as well.
Can you share from your perspective some of the reasons you feel the death penalty is wrong?
Even the Amnesty International position is completely understandable. It's a violation of human rights, even by its concept, that it violates Article 3 on the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which is the right to life or the right to live. As well as Article 5, in practice, it's a violation of the right to be free from cruel or inhumane treatment or punishment. It's an ineffective approach to crime. It doesn't deter crime. It can be significantly more costly in a modern system. There's no way to undo a wrongful execution. Frequently we find it's applied to people based on issues that are nothing to do with the severity of the crime, but may have more to do with the characteristics of the offender or of the victim. So we see racism cropping up during death sentences, and issues of those who can't simply afford a good lawyer, so poverty is targeted. There's nothing good about the system, and there's no way to fix it. There's nothing that can be done to make it quote unquote work.
So it's a socioeconomic racism issue.
Well, that's just part of it. Like I said, you can't undo a wrongful conviction, and even innocent people will confess to crime. There are other things, too. If you go around the world, particularly, you see death sentences often imposed for crimes which don't meet international standards that would allow for the death penalty. So they're being applied to things like drug smuggling or financial corruption. But as I said, it's a broken system. It doesn't work. And it's an approach to crime which is really just a waste of human life, a waste of other resources, and may simply be contributing to other crime as well.
Amnesty International released its annual review of the death penalty worldwide. It showed an alarming increase in 2015. Can you share some of the highlights that were in the report?
It's been extreme on both ends. We've had a surge in executions globally, so almost 50% more people were executed in 2015 than the previous year, and that is the highest number we'd seen in 25 years. However, on the opposite side of the spectrum, we had four countries that had completely abolished the death penalty from their law books in 2015, bringing to a total of 102 countries that are now fully abolitionist in law. If you add to that the number of countries that simply don't practice it, that comes to about 140 countries, which is by far the largest proportion. It's on 2/3 of the world that aren't using the death penalty. So it's really a minority of countries, and within those, that surge in executions, we don't count China, only because China has continued to refuse to provide any official statistics, and we don't believe the numbers are reliable that we're able to get from them. But in just three countries, they're responsible for about 90% of all the recorded executions. So Iran, Pakistan, and Saudi Arabia, those have seen the highest surges. Pakistan only recently resumed executions and last year executed several hundred people. Iran, we've seen a gradual increase in a gradual surge, over the last few years in executions, probably in part due to a desire to politically control people in the country and keep the population in greater fear. Saudi Arabia has been increasing their executions under the new king. There have been some legal reforms, but it hasn't really slowed down their execution machine.
Iran continues to execute juvenile offenders, those aged 18 at the time of the alleged crime, which is in violation of international law, and Pakistan and the Maldives are also sentencing juveniles to death. Is Amnesty doing anything to work towards eradicating that?
Yeah, the definition of a juvenile offender is for somebody who is under the age of 18 at the time of the crime. So it doesn't matter what age they are at the time they are sentenced or what age they are at the time the execution is carried out. Iran and Saudi Arabia are probably the leading countries with executing people for these crimes, but a small number of countries as well are continuing to do so. And this is a violation not simply of standards, but of international law.
Right.
It's laid out quite explicitly particularly in two major documents, the Convention on the Rights of the Child and the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. Amnesty International is one of many organizations that speaks out quite strongly against juvenile executions. We have had movements to do with that. We work closely with other groups, including the Canadian group Stop Child Executions, which is particularly focused on Iran, but is it really a global issue with regards to child executions? I said there's only a small number of countries that are doing this, but it's disturbing, to say the least. And many of these executions, because of the causes of crime, sometimes they are for crimes that, even if they were grown-ups, shouldn't meet the international standards for the death penalty. So drug smuggling is particularly one that is often targeted.
And what else is disturbing is countries are also in contravention of international law by putting to death people with mental or intellectual disabilities, including the U.S., as well as those charged with non-lethal crimes such as adultery, blasphemy, corruption, kidnapping, and questioning leaders' policies. It's quite disturbing.
Yeah, well, that's kind of a mixed thing. At the United Nations, there is the safeguards to protect those facing the death penalty, and in those are listed a number of things which the United Nations Economic and Social Committee, which is the lead on these issues, has said, you know, if you're going to have the death penalty, you need to make sure that you meet these conditions, including not executing people with severe mental illness, including not executing juvenile offenders, including making sure that they have the right to appeal, the right to ability to have commutation or clemency applied to them, which is something which we do frequently ask of governments where there are pending executions. The battle is on kind of two fronts with ending the death penalty. One is on changing the laws, and the other is on trying to prevent the existing executions, which we do focused on issues of legal issues and of human rights issues, particularly where they intersect. There are many countries that have listed crimes that are very vaguely defined that do not meet the international standards. So, you know, questioning the leader, that was in North Korea. We heard about some of those. But it's also applied sometimes through other ways in countries like Iran and Saudi Arabia, where, you know, questioning the government or challenging or protesting is turned into a form of treason and then applied. Then the death penalty is being applied there or threatened as a way to silence any political dissent.
You'd mentioned Pakistan as well. They had originally lifted the freeze on executions in December 2014 after an attack on a school in Peshawar for those charged with terrorist-related activities and offenses. However, Pakistan executed 326 people, the highest number ever recorded by Amnesty, and people in Pakistan are routinely denied the right to a fair trial, and evidence is typically extracted through torture and to seal convictions. And these people are executed under the pretense of justice being served. So the death penalty now continues in Pakistan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, and that is an issue, and it's not there. While they said initially they were only going to be executing people convicted on terrorism offenses, that is no longer the case. Pakistan is executing people convicted of other lesser, you know, crimes, simpler crimes like murder. There are cases of religious minorities being accused and convicted of apostasy and of other religious levels of crime, such as insulting the prophet, which is being used as a way of oppressing, again, certain minorities within Pakistan, but using the death penalty to do so. So it is very troubling, having seen this dramatic surge in Pakistan. Pakistan also has a number of juvenile offenders on their death rows at the moment, despite the fact that quite a few years ago they were supposed to have ended their use of the death penalty against child offenders based on statements from previous governments.
If I can just ask something, Aubrey, that I've been wondering about is, you know, that you're well aware that there's a debate within many faith communities around the death penalty, and, you know, the one that we'd be familiar with particularly is within the Christian faith. There's a really strong advocate for the abolition of the death penalty, Sister Prejean, who spoke here at the University of Regina within the last year. It was a fabulously attended event.
Excellent, yeah.
Yeah, and there are people who, you know, are within the Christian faith who take the different perspective. But I'm wondering, you know, knowing that she's such a powerful voice within the Christian faith for the abolition of the death penalty, when you look at other faiths internationally, for example, within the Muslim community, are there voices who call for the abolition of the death penalty as well?
Yes, there are. There are quite a few. When we go to, we often will have, for example, at the World Congress Against the Death Penalty, which is held every 3 years, and many abolitionist organizations attend. There regularly talks about religion and the death penalty, and we have representatives of the Judeo-Christian faith and the Muslim faith and sometimes other faiths. And they're all speaking against the death penalty. We've certainly seen, and the variation that, you know, has been seen before in the Christian faith is becoming more and more consistently opposed to the death penalty. United States, we're hearing more evangelical movements speaking against the death penalty. The Catholic Church has been quite vocally opposed to the death penalty, beginning with Pope John Paul II, but even more so with the current Pope. And we've heard these things, some of the arguments even from the Jewish leaders that we've heard have pointed to the fact that even though that there's mention of the death penalty in the older texts, that in fact they specify such high standards for evidence and having witnessed the crime, you need to, you know, see the entire crime. It's not just good enough to see somebody enter a house and then leave the house and discover a murder. It needs to fully be witnessed just for that to be considered proof enough to allow it. But the idea that they say behind that sort of level of evidence is the idea that really you should never be carrying it out.
Interesting. Thank you.
So can you share some information specifically about the progress in terms of the United States and the campaign to abolish the death penalty? The number of states with the death penalty is 31 currently.
Well, we've seen a lot of different things going on. Nebraska this past year had passed legislation over the head of the governor, but the legislation was to repeal the death penalty, to remove the death penalty, and that's coming from both sides of the political spectrum as well. We're seeing more and more right-wing conservative politicians also coming on side with the more traditionally more traditional sources of abolition movement, i.e. in the left, the political left spectrum of the Democrats particularly. And we are seeing this kind of stuff. However, the governor there, for example, has sunk a lot of his own personal money into a campaign to force the repeal onto a referendum. So it's a question of whether there was to repeal the repeal and bring the death penalty back to Nebraska. Other places, Texas has recently been told they cannot import lethal injection drugs anymore, the ones that they're trying to get. Many places have been resorting to what they call compounding pharmacies because the traditional large manufacturers of drugs are refusing to provide these drugs to the states. Some states have started passing legislation for backup methods, the older, even more visibly cruel methods, such as the electric chair and firing squads have been considered for means of execution. But the issue, one of the issues is that the death penalty using lethal injection, even though it may, even if it looks like somebody's going to sleep, and it doesn't always look like somebody's going to sleep, but even if it does look like somebody's going to sleep, they're often administered a paralytic drug as part of the process, which means that they're paralyzed. They cannot move. They cannot show any pain. And so we don't really know what they're going through. Many of the drugs that are being used now because of the phasing out of older anesthetics are drugs that were designed to be easier to bring somebody out of their coma with, because they're designed for surgery. They're not designed to kill people.
Right.
So when they're resorting to these other newer drugs, it truly is a human experiment with an intentional aim of destroying the person. But we are seeing, as I said, more progress. California seems to be wavering. We've had some very close attempts to abolish the death penalty by referendum in California. And we've had moratoriums in place in a number of states. I believe Washington and Pennsylvania currently have moratoriums in place for their executions. Texas, actually in the United States, they have still, I believe in 2015, they had the lowest number of recorded executions in 24 years. So there's progress. It's a combination of efforts at abolition as well as challenges to states being able to carry out the death penalty. And what we're seeing happening at the Supreme Court as well, with, you know, for example, the passing of Justice Scalia, who was a long-term advocate of the death penalty, could potentially mean a shift in balance on the Supreme Court that may result in the elimination of the death penalty based on a Supreme Court decision, as happened in 1972. Which resulted only in a 4-year period without the death penalty, but the arguments have just become stronger and stronger for abolition ever since then. So that might be the tipping point that we need.
Right. I was reading last night that in the United States alone, since 1973, 156 death row inmates have been acquitted after innocence was established using various methods and criteria to establish reasons for acquittal. So it's not necessarily people, you know, are on death row and they are found to be innocent. So the death penalty is not the answer.
Yeah, that's a very good point. That, I mean, even where we don't have the death penalty here in Canada, we have a problem with people who are wrongly convicted.
Mm-hmm.
And we're never going to get it correct 100% of the time, whether you're convicting people. It is a human system and it's not going to be perfect. But when you have the end result being a state-sanctioned execution, a homicide of somebody simply because they were convicted of a crime, it really is a problem there that you cannot undo it. You have the suffering of a whole other family involved in this, and it's not just the family of the person who may have been a victim of murder, but the family of the person condemned. Whether or not they're innocent, it's a problem.
Well, Aubrey, it's Jim Hutchings here, and we're just about to the bottom of the hour, and we're going to take a break. But first, we have to mention our Look and Listen Lottery here at CJTR. It's one of our major fundraisers, and it's on the go here right now. We're selling tickets for $20 each, with only 1,500 available, and we're going to make a draw on May 13th. For some pretty, May 13th. Last sale is May 12th. And we have some pretty fabulous prizes for our supporters who buy a ticket. We have a choice of the grand prize, a choice of 4 places they could go to. A wonderful trip for a week. Cleveland, Ohio. Nashville, Tennessee. New Orleans, Louisiana. And Las Vegas, Nevada. So there's lots of good things to see in those places. The second prize is a $1,000 travel voucher from Carlson Vaughanly Rickert Travel. And third prize is 2 weekend passes to the Regina Folk Festival 2016. So really interesting prizes there. And it's, like I say, this lottery is an important fundraiser for CJTR. We're a volunteer-driven radio station with more than 100 volunteers delivering a wide diversity of music, spoken word, and multicultural programs. And by supporting the Look and Listen Lottery, you are helping Regina Community Radio. You can buy tickets at CJTR's offices at 1102 8th Avenue or by calling the radio station at 306-525-7274 during regular office hours, Monday through Friday. And you can get more details by going to www.cjtr.ca. So Like I say, it's time for our break, and we're going to play some music that Aubrey picked right out of the break. So we will be right back.
There's a pale horse coming, and I'm going riding. I'll rise in the morning, my fate decided, my dead man walking, my dead man walking. In St. James Parish, I was born and christened, but I've got my story. Rest, I ain't no need for you to listen. It's just a dead man talking. Once I had a job, I had a girl. Between our dreams and actions lie this world. In the deep forest, the blood and tears rushed over me. All I could feel was the drugs and the shotgun. My fear up inside of me, like a dead man talking. Neath the summer sky, my eyes went blank. Sister, I won't ask for forgiveness. My sins are all I have. Tonight the clouds above my prison, they move slowly across the sky. There's a new day dawning. My dreams are full too.
And we are back. So, Aubrey, I've just asked you to comment there. Why did you pick that tune?
Well, there are a lot of songs out there that relate to the death penalty, some of which are more surprising than others, like The Green, Green Grass of Home and Strange Fruit, obviously, is another one. But I felt that Dead Man Walking was one that isn't played a lot these days, but it has a good mood to it, and enough people are familiar with the film and with Sister Helen Prejean, for example, and it's just a very nice song too, a good song.
Right, yeah. And just on that point, there seem to be, I think, more and more films and documentaries about people who have been wrongly convicted, and they come out of prison perhaps 20 years on death row, and they end up exonerated by, new evidence of one sort or another. And, it would have been a huge injustice for them to have been executed. And of course, we have our own instances here in Canada where, we've had a couple of people whose names escape me, of course, with one in Nova Scotia and one in Saskatchewan where there were murders. And,
David Milgaard
was one that I was thinking of. Yeah. But he was convicted of the murder, and if there had been a death penalty, he could conceivably have been executed. And then there was another one in Nova Scotia. Mm-hmm. Again, you're probably familiar with that, Aubrey, but
also the case of Wilbert Coffin, who was executed in, I believe, the 50s.
Right.
When a couple of American hunters were found murdered, and his son is somebody who I'm in contact with, and certainly when it comes to cases in the United States where we hear about Innocence, Kirk Bloodsworth. There was a documentary just recently put out about his story, and he was the first man ever exonerated based on DNA proof of his innocence. You know, even if you, one of the problems that you hear sometimes when people are advocating for the death penalty is to say, well, DNA is keeping the innocent people from being executed, but that's not the case. DNA isn't available in many murder cases and many trials, and evidence may be lost. There's obviously the issue of potential tampering as well. So there are a lot of factors involved with that and with other kinds of evidence out there. And then there are many people who simply serve out their sentences, having, you know, perhaps been commuted, but were quiet. So Stephen Truscott, who was a Canadian,
yes.
He was sentenced to death when he was just 14 years old.
Right.
In the 1950s, but a very quiet guy who served out a sentence despite his innocence and was only a few years ago exonerated in that sense. It's difficult to say exoneration because a lot of times in Canadian justice we don't do a formal exoneration. It's simply that they withdraw the charges or they're found not guilty.
And what, as one, yeah.
Yeah, we don't go to the point of showing actual innocence at times because it, I don't know exactly why. I think it's an injustice that we don't have the ability to do that, to properly compensate those people.
Mm-hmm.
There is an association based out of Toronto, but which was originated by Reuben Hurricane Carter called the Association Defense of the Wrongly Convicted, who are in agreement with us in abolition of the death penalty. And who are people that we sometimes work quite closely with for events and materials to do with the issue of innocence on death row. But Amnesty, of course, we're not only opposed to the death penalty for innocent people, but we're opposed to the death penalty for anyone.
Yep, exactly. Exactly. And one thing I find really disquieting is that there are instances in some jurisdictions in the state where the innocence has been pretty reliably established, and the people in charge refuse to recognize that, and they just keep trucking along with that death penalty, and it just doesn't make any sense.
Two names in particular come to mind with that would be Troy Davis, who was executed in Georgia just a few years ago. His conviction was only based on the testimony, I believe, of nine people. There was no physical evidence linking to the crime, and he never confessed to the crime either. But since his trial, seven people had recanted or changed their testimony substantially to indicate he was innocent. One person could not be found, and the other witness was the prime ulterior suspect in the case, against whom there were a number of witnesses willing to step forward and testify that it was in fact him and not Troy. And the other particularly obvious one that is talked about quite a bit in the United States is Cameron Todd Willingham, who was executed in Texas by Governor Rick Perry's orders. He'd been convicted in, there'd been a fire at his house. His children had died. He was accused of having deliberately set this fire to kill his children. And the evidence that was used against him was forensic evidence provided by somebody who was never formally trained in fire, in arson issues.
Oh,
he'd had, you know, been schooled by longstanding traditions, which were known even at that time to be incorrect. So he was claiming things like spider or crazy glass, I think they called it, just to do with the way that the glass is cracked in the windows, and saying that indicates that there was an accelerant used. And even before the execution, there were arson and fire experts from around the world writing to Rick Perry saying, we know this is junk science, this is not real, there's nothing better than witchcraft that's being used to convict this guy. There's no indication of an actual crime having happened, and he should be released. Not only not executed, but released. The execution went ahead, and subsequent to that, there was a commission in Texas looking at what ways to better improve their forensic science used in convictions in anything in the justice system. And they had a attempted to re-examine the William case, at which point Governor Perry abruptly stopped the committee and removed a number of people from the committee and reappointed new people to the committee in order that there would be no examination of the potential innocence of Cameron Todd William.
Well, to say that we have a flawed system there is an understatement.
So, Aubrey, can you share some information on current campaigns that are working actively to stop the execution of prisoners, ongoing campaigns right now?
We do have quite a few ongoing urgent actions. The way that, often urgent actions will only come to the fore when there's an imminent execution. We've been speaking out quite publicly because we're seeing some particularly troubling cases. For example, in Egypt, where we get hundreds of people tried in a single trial and sentenced to death en masse. So there's been issues in Egypt, in Iran. We do have cases in the United States, urgent actions that if you Google Amnesty International and urgent actions and the death penalty, you'll find a rather large list of ongoing urgent actions related to people who are facing imminent execution. In general, what we do when we encourage our members to write to the governments, and this can maybe to the head of government or to people on the board of pardons and paroles, depending on the level of things. But we are asking for commutation of sentence. Usually, we don't usually ask for immediate release of people because these, in many cases, certainly not all, but in many cases. That we're writing to, they may be to do with a murder case, for example. So there's an accusation of a serious crime. We're not saying that, people should not be in jail for having committed murder. We're simply saying they shouldn't be executed. Although there are troubling cases that we see and we highlight in our urgent actions about unfair trials, people being denied the right to appeal or being denied the ability to present their own evidence at a case or at a court. We're seeing special military courts being used to sentence people to death, which is also a violation of international fair trial standards and international standards on the death penalty. So those are the sort of things that we are seeing at the moment. We do have cases in Iran at the moment of juvenile offenders being sentenced to death and facing imminent execution. There is a recent case in the United States, and I don't know the current status on it, but where the prosecutor had quite overtly talked about the models of race as a justification for the person being sentenced to death. Another case where one of the jurors made a derogatory racist statement after the fact about giving that person, they didn't use the word person, what they deserved as to why he sent him to death, and it was a racial slur that was used. So we're seeing a lot of issues like that in current cases. This is not something from 1970. This is something that's happened within the last few years. We're still seeing these issues arise. So I would encourage people to look on the Amnesty websites for our urgent actions and find the existing cases and look through, and you may not want to write on some cases if that's your personal thing, but I definitely encourage you to look through, because you're going to find many, many troubling cases going on. And even if someone is not completely opposed to death penalty, they're going to find cases that they are completely shocked that these sorts of executions and these sorts of death sentences are going ahead.
Aubrey, something I was wondering if you might be able to share a little bit about is you referenced a little while ago the organization that Hurricane Carter's involved with. Mm-hmm. But some of the other organizations that are working for the abolition of the death penalty and sort of related justice issues, I'm thinking of groups like the Southern Poverty Law Center and others.
There are such a wide variety. There are obviously some that are religious based, and that's not Amnesty's arguments. We're not a religious organization, so we're not going to be bringing up biblical quotes. But such a Prejean can certainly provide you with some. However, there are groups, one of the more interesting ones that I've encountered have been groups such as Journey of Hope and Murder Victims Families for Human Rights. And these are people that are directly affected by the death penalty, and in some cases they are the surviving family members of murder victims that are opposed to the death penalty and in favor of human rights. I was amazed to hear some of these people speak at conferences. One night they had an evening completely devoted to the sort of group, and on stage was a woman speaking whose father was a conservative politician who'd been killed by an IRA bomb in England, I think Brighton. And she was on stage talking about these issues, but she was on stage speaking alongside the IRA man who'd planted the bomb.
And is that right?
About how this was the way she was seeking closure, was in just trying to understand what had happened. And in many cases, this is what many victims' families have said, is they really just want to understand what happened. The idea of closure based on somebody else being killed is proven to be a false idea in psychological studies, psychiatric studies have shown. Not only is there no real closure, but even going through the witnessing of an execution is severely psychologically damaging to people. People end up with post-traumatic stress disorder from having witnessed these things. It's even worse for those people who have to carry out the executions. But these other organizations, Murder Victims Challenge for Human Rights, the Southern Poverty Law Center, the National Coalition for the Advancement of Colored People, these are all groups, those are particularly American groups, but they're also worldwide groups. Within Europe, there are many various groups, and we're all, and in Africa and Asia, there are less obvious ones in the Middle East, because in many cases, there's a lot of political oppression, but we're not the only ones speaking out, and we are supportive of local groups. In Iran, there's particularly groups that are opposed to stonings as a method of execution, and they speak out, and we are supportive of them in opposing this particularly brutal method of execution.
Getting back to the person that was talking about the IRA, her father had been killed. Mahatma Gandhi said, "An eye for an eye will make the whole world blind," and it's true. How can we justify treating a crime, such as a murder of someone, with punishment that mirrors the very thing that we so adamantly condemn? And I was reading about that as well. Many people do not look to the death penalty to justify closure when one of their family members. Others will say, no, we do want it, because that's how, this is how we want closure in our lives. But many do not want that.
Well, I mean, and it's hard to understand to say with complete certainty what the actual reasons are for people who call for executions are. But it could well be suggested that many of the people are simply saying what they've been told over and over again growing up, is that that's how you get justice. Mm-hmm. That's what justice is. And they haven't really understood that they're not going to be healed by these things. There are those who have made claims about deterrence as well, which is another issue. After hundreds of studies that have been done on this issue, there has never been an actual proof of any significant, any actual deterrence from the death penalty greater than a serious prison sentence. And they've done quite a bit of study on it. As you can imagine, there have been studies that have claimed to show a deterrence, and yet, after a very short period of time, they've all been shown to be seriously flawed. There are some studies which actually claim the exact opposite, that executions are driving up homicide rates, And that's something which you can understand if you look at the statistics. If you look within the United States, those states that have state-level death penalties versus those states that don't have state-level death penalties, the murder rates are generally per capita much higher in those that have a death penalty than those that don't. And if you look where law enforcement officers are killed in the line of duty feloniously, so not having a car crash, but by being shot, for example, by someone, there are greater numbers of law enforcement officers killed feloniously in the active death penalty areas in the States than there are in the non-death penalty active areas. And those are just straight out, you know, simple statistics. But they would seem to back up the idea that the death penalty may actually cause more homicide and other violent crime than not having it.
Aubrey, I wonder if you could share a little bit about the situation with respect to the position of the Government of Canada, particularly the new Government of Canada, compared to the previous one relative to situations where Canadians may be on death row. I'm thinking particularly of a few examples of people in the United States who are on death row.
Yeah. So under the previous government, the government of Stephen Harper, there was a dramatic shift away from abolition. While the Canadian government did continue to support United Nations MOOCs calling for a global moratorium on executions, the government of the day then refused to co-sponsor, and they had all. While they did help to prevent wrecking amendments, and they did eventually vote in favor of it when it came to a vote, it was a very unusual position for a country that has been a long-term abolitionist country. We haven't had an execution since 1962. We removed it from our own law books. Ordinary crimes in 1976, and we got rid of it from any mention in our law books in 1998. We've ratified the second optional protocol to the International Covenant of Civil Political Rights, which states that there is no, that you will not carry an execution ever, and which there's no means to withdraw. These are all very significant steps, and yet the government at that time was refusing to simply co-sponsor, just raising a hand in a meeting or making a telephone call. And when it comes to Canadians who are at risk of execution, the Canadian government had simply announced, spur of the moment, that they were no longer going to support clemency in some cases of the death penalties. They were generally trying to have the death penalty carried out by proxy, people that they didn't really care for, didn't want to, or they were making a political statement. They were taken to court, and in federal court, they were ordered to continue to support the clemency efforts for Ron Smith in Montana because his rights had been quite clearly violated by the way that they got around doing that. And yet, when they did write a letter, it was they made it quite clear that they were only writing a letter because they were ordered to by court. They really made a very weak attempt at seeking clemency, despite the fact that the governor of Montana had been perceived as potentially quite receptive of seeking clemency for him. In the end, the governor didn't extend clemency, but simply put it off. And Ron Smith is one of two people on death row in Montana, which is not a very active death penalty state. It's going to be quite some time, I think, before we get a complete resolution to this, but he's not an imminent threat of execution at the moment. The government of the new government that's come in has been has actually made quite strong statements opposing the death penalty and saying that it doesn't matter what crime, it doesn't matter what the political state of the country is, Canada will support clemency for Canadians who are facing death sentences overseas. So it's been quite a good shift, but it's simply a return to what was the Canadian position for decades prior to the Conservative government that was just in. We had seen a slow progression over time, but in terms of prime ministers, the Prime Minister Harper was the first pro-death penalty Admiralty Prime Minister that Canada had had since before John Diefenbaker, from John Diefenbaker all the way up to Paul Martin, was a continuous line on both political parties that were in power of prime ministers that opposed the death penalty. So it's good that we are have returned and had a formal statement made returning to the policy, and we do hope that Canada will now also co-sponsor at the United Nations these moves calling for a universal moratorium on executions with a view to getting rid of the death penalty around the world.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Well, I think we've kind of run out of time here, folks. The hour flies by, and I would really like to thank Aubrey for being here today to talk about the death penalty. It's been great talking to you, Aubrey.
Thank you.
Thanks,
thank
Aubrey.
You.
And on behalf of my hosts here, Gord and Daylene, I'd just like to thank everyone for listening. As we close this week's Human Rights Radio on CJTR Community Radio, we hope you've enjoyed listening to and have learned something new about human rights for all people. If you have any questions about today's show or other human rights questions, email us at humanrightsradio@cjtr.ca. Pioneering human rights campaigner Peter Benenson said, "Only when the last prisoner of conscience has been freed, the last torture chamber has been closed, the United Nations Universal Declaration of Human Rights is a reality for the world's people, will our work be done."